daddies are so hot right now. But what if you discover your lover's secret sugar daddy is also your own biological father? Does that make it even hotter? Or did things just get too weird?
Today, the golden-voiced Andrew Pifko joins us to talk about his new film, Daddy Issues, where he's caught in a love triangle with his own daughter's girlfriend. After studying microbiology, Andrew Pifko pursued a career in acting and went on to star in a car commercial with the Muppets and played the maitre d' in Sarah Jessica Parker's Super Bowl beer commercial.
Why did we ever stop drinking these? Listen as Andrew chats with us about squeezing into a van with all the Muppets, working on Mel Brooks' new movie, The Olympians, and starring in More Guns, the NRA musical, now at Second City Hollywood. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Feast of Fun is made possible because of fabulous people just like you. Thank you. Become a member and support this show at feastoffun.com/plus.
Hello there.
Hi, Jeff. Andrew, sorry.
Andrew.
I was thinking about Jeff Bridges.
Yeah, just now.
Okay. Oh, right. Yeah, listen, I'll just do a dude voice and it'll be as if you're interviewing him. Let me get a big sweater on.
Let me adjust our sound volumes.
Okay. Here. Do you want me to turn mine down or?
You sound a little hot. Like there's a.
Okay,
like
yeah,
a,
I can turn mine down. Wait, let me turn mine down.
There happening or something.
How's that? I turned that down a little bit.
You sound great. You sound like the movie phone guy.
If you're calling for Jeff Bridges, press 2. If you're calling for Sarah Jessica Parker, press 999.
Is this Andrew Pifko?
This is Jeff Bridges. I wouldn't speak to Andrew Pifko if my life depended on it.
Well, he's all who we can get today. I'm sorry.
You know, that's fair. That's fair. Is that still hot audio-wise? You want me to turn that down a bit?
You sound amazing.
Sweet. Is it cool? All right,
yeah,
let's just keep going.
It sounds like we're
stuff.
Talking to the movie phone guy.
Okay, great.
So I want to go catch Avengers Endgame. Yeah. What time is the midnight showing going to be exactly?
Will you be buying popcorn with your purchase? You can have some free. You can have some free Junior Mints with your purchase and also a free wallet. You know, just like place in daily promotions as you're going along there.
You know, I work at the mall. 20 kids came out of an Endgame. They're like, oh my God, you can't believe what happens in the movie. I'm like, get out of here.
Right? It's funny. I just read a story yesterday, 2 days ago. There was some dude in the lineup in China and he had already seen the movie. And he was literally standing outside the line of people waiting to go in. And he started shouting out spoilers to the people who were waiting in line to go in. Mm-hmm. And he was beaten to a pulp. Like all these moviegoers just went to town on him.
Well, I don't condone violence, but I feel like, you know.
Yeah, never condone violence, but it's not unjustified.
Yeah, I don't think the police did anything. They just kind of stood there and said, well, I don't want to know about Endgame either.
The emergency crews came.
And the police themselves were holding, like, instead of guns, they had, like, Mjolnir, you know, in there. And I'm like, wow, Chinese police have, you know, Asgardian hammers. That's pretty awesome.
Well, Andrew, I forgot to introduce myself. I'm Fausto.
And I'm Mark.
Hey, good to meet you both.
And you're on Feast of Fun right now. And
fantastic.
Can I call you daddy?
The safety word is mommy.
Well, you have this wonderful new film that's coming soon to theaters near you.
Yes, it has just come to theaters. We just opened just a few days ago, and we're now streaming on all the major iTunes, Google Play, On Demand. Like as of a few, just like 48 hours ago, which is amazing.
The film is Daddy Issues, and you play a dad who discovers that his... How does the plot works? Because I don't want to give it away for the people who haven't watched it, but...
Sure.
It's a love triangle.
It's, you know, there's a dual story. There's a story of, the general theme is this beautiful approach to fluid sexuality, which is the core of its theme and how love expresses itself in a, you know... In a hetero way, in an LGBT way, and just all the different forms that it can flourish in. Set against that is also an estranged relationship between a daughter and her father, and everybody, you know, within it has their own daddy issues. I do play the titular role of daddy. But it speaks to the issues that each one of us have. So there is the beauty of the love that each one of us has, and also sometimes the baggage that we have attached to how we approach love.
So are you a biological daddy, or you're a sugar daddy, or I guess...
Well, his daughter's a lesbian, okay. And the daughter has an affair with another woman, or falls in love with this woman who's a dominatrix, I guess, or something, or... She's a wild woman.
She's a wild woman. I don't think she's dominatrix, but certainly she's present and she's aware and she really embraces her own sexuality. The woman who's at the sort of the center of this triangle.
And then all hell breaks loose when you discover that you guys are both in love with the same woman.
Yeah, it's. I mean, that's what really propels the plot. What propels the narrative is these stages of discovery. Who mm-hmm. knows what, when, and that's. It's a great narrative conceit that you as the audience are always two steps ahead, and the characters, like any good movie, have to catch up with what the audience already knows.
You know, I love that Netflix is becoming more and more like Mexican telenovelas. You know what I'm saying?
It sells.
Right.
You're having all these like twists and turns, a lot of, I don't want to call it sex gratuitous, because mm-hmm. is there ever a sex scene or a sexual scene in a movie that couldn't be looked upon that way? And it's fun to see, you know, just kind of like what happens when filmmakers just have no restrictions.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this, I think any good film, the sex scene in any good film will always be, a good sex scene anyhow, will always be a continuation of the narrative. If it's a comedy, if it's coming out of band camp, then in a comedy, then it's the sex scene will approach the comedic aspect of that. If it's approaching it from the sort of fluid sexuality perspective, then it's going to come from that perspective. So any good sex scene in a film should be a continuation of the narrative and not like, boom, it just sort of pops out of nowhere. That's usually the sign of a bad film. And with mm-hmm. daddy issues, the sex scenes that happen here and, you know, the love scenes that happen here are an extension of Amara Cash, the director, her aesthetic and her narrative conceit.
But do you have like any family members, like your mom or something? It's like, can't you be in a more wholesome movie?
Well, actually, it's funny. So I'm originally from Toronto, and Toronto has one of the oldest and largest LGBT theaters, Buddies in Bad Times Theater, in North America. Mm. And my mom is an avid theater goer, and she actually is, not only does she herself have a season pass to Buddies in Bad Times Theater in Stratford and Shaw, but she actively brings people to see theater of all types. And that's certainly one that she would celebrate. My dad, not so, you know, he's very, a little bit more conservative, but supportive. Mm-hmm. But they were definitely, so long as it feels right for the craft, they've always been, you know, surprised, beautifully, surprisingly, incredibly supportive.
You have one of the greatest careers of any guest that we've ever had recently.
Oh, dude. So sweet of you to say.
Well, because, you know, you got to be Sarah Jessica Parker's waiter in the Stella.
Insane.
That's
right.
Our toys.
Yeah.
As
her maitre d'.
Jeff Bridges calls it. Yep. Yeah. You got her be our maitre d'. And so I guess it's like a little, for the people who haven't watched it, it's a Super Bowl ad. And she, instead of ordering a Cosmopolitan, she causes chaos in the restaurant because she wanted a beer.
Right.
And classy ladies don't drink beer.
Right. What part of Cosmopolitan don't you get? Well, the part where you get a Stella.
But I could totally see you being like a regular actor or character in, you know, Sex and the City.
Yeah, you know, why not? I mean, listen, you slick back the hair, give me some horn-rimmed glasses, and boom, I'm just like on my way to Manolo Blahnik's.
So, Andrew, how does that shoot work exactly? Because it seems like... Sure. You just show up and do the, you know, it seems relatively simple, but I imagine that it's a very complicated process to shoot this dynamic, quick slapstick comedy ad that lasts 30 seconds.
Yeah. Like a commercial is, it's actually a pretty detailed thing that you have to tell a pretty cogent story inside of 30 or 60 seconds, depending on the edit. Like looking back at that commercial, if you think of every single shot, the glass exploding, wires exploding, things happening on fire, people reacting to it. It was 2 days. The first day was 21 hours. The second day was like 22 or 23 hours. And you're talking hundreds and hundreds of extra, of crew, of talent.
2 days to do a beer ad with Sarah Jessica Parker.
And Jeff Bridges.
And by the end of the second day, she's like, can we go home now, please?
Well, hopefully they gave her, you know, a cozy couch to sit on. And I'm pretty sure they did. But no, it's actually a pretty meticulous process. And, you know, everything from, you know, the froth on the beer to everything to the aesthetic, to making sure that the aesthetic dovetails with the narrative of who those characters are, who the dude is. Like, it's not just the people, but, you know, the dude brings with himself a huge aesthetic, and Sarah Jessica Parker brings the aesthetic of what it was to be Carrie. And so you're talking about the textures, the fabrics and whatnot. So leading up to that day are weeks and months of preparation on behalf of, you know, the production team. What are the colors? What are the, you know, what is the whole world? Because when you think of, you know, Sex and the City or the Big Lebowski, it's the whole world. Think of what did the film look like? What was the, you know, what was the world around the characters? From my perspective, it was, you know, two auditions, trying out different accents. Eventually we arrived at an English one, but I, you know, brought in my German and my Israeli and whatever. So you're trying to find out, okay, what would dovetail specifically? There's a great moment in the audition process. This particular director loves to have his actors just dance. Just dance. They say, okay, we're going to play some, without you knowing about it, just they're going to play some at the callback. They played some music and you just kind of dance to it. And it's their way of seeing, like, what are you at your base self? And because he found, and he's found over the years, that when you play music and you just let somebody dance, that is the truest form of expression.
Mm. I love that idea.
To be honest, in my entire career, I've never seen that. And it's beautiful and it's raw. Because at the end of a 21-hour shoot day, you're damn sure going to see what everybody's base self is going to be. Mm-hmm. Either they'll rise to the occasion or they'll shrivel from it. And to be called upon in a moment's notice without any preparation, you will be seen in your truest, rawest self. And I felt it was a really beautiful way of seeing things. So that was, you know, my preparation. That's their winnowing process of, you know, coming down to me, or it could have been somebody else.
So you busted some moves and you got the job.
You know, daddy's got to go halftime or full time, whatever, you know, you drop a mother trucker beat and I'll oblige.
Well, it strikes me like you're doing kind of what a lot of drag queens do, which is, you know, lose yourself in the fantasy of the music.
Sure.
And then we sort of, like, by trying to lip sync or dance to something that we connect with, we allow the audience to reveal our true selves. And that's ultimately what, like, theater and acting is, right? It's this duality of transforming yourself into something else by revealing who you really are.
Absolutely. There are many ways to go into, like, in the stand-up. The best time that I've ever had in stand-up is when you don't put on a character, you don't put on a mask, but you reveal your, you know, you show your wounds because the audience can't. Uh-huh. And in so doing, you don't try to make it therapy, but you make it universal enough that they can understand their pain through you suffering it.
And you identify as Animal from the Muppets.
I do. You know,
in various interviews, they asked you this question because you've worked with the Muppets, and they're just like, why Animal?
He's just great. Like, if you ever think of, you know, I mean, you talk about, you know, drag queen performance and giving yourself over to the music. I can think of no other character that has a sense of abandon. Yeah. That just to give yourself over, like, you know, just a kid in the sandbox. Animal just goes. And that is your id. That is your, what do they call it? Your reptilian self.
Mm-hmm.
And he really does. You just, like, embrace. Think about a kid who's seen chocolate cake for the first time. They ram their face into that thing. They throw it all over the place. So if you can embrace that with your art in a specific way, that you can, then that's the ultimate, you know, personification of that. So I do bring up, you know, him, and I bring up Animal, but that's as a, the larger thing is, how do you throw yourself into something with absolute abandon and then just, you know, take a nap for a while, because it's pretty exhausting to be Animal for a long period of time.
Well, you know that Howie Mandel used to do the voice for Animal in Muppet Babies.
Aww. Oh, was he that?
Yeah. That's how
he did that. I remember he did that other high pitched voice. I forget what it was. Bobby's World?
Bobby. Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. He was doing that voice. He also did the voice for Muppet Babies, the cartoon in the late 80s.
I didn't know that.
And, you know, the animal puppet actually was one of Jim Henson's earliest Muppets, the character. It was based on the Manamana Muppet.
Right.
Which was, an Italian pop song at the time. Manamana. Doo, 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 doo.
Oh, really?
You know,
I did not know. It was originally like a 60s Italian.
Yeah, it was, you know, this weird, nonsensical doo-wop kind of song. And awesome. Jim Henson really liked it a lot. And so you got these two weird alien big mouth.
Right. No,
Muppets.
Those I remember. Mana Mana. You can go around the world, you know, Russian, Arabic, whatever. You drop a Mana Mana and you're going to get a do-do-do-do-do, whatever country you go to.
It's a universal language, right? Like music, but also this song just spoke to us as children, right? And totally. So for you to like sort of identify with animal is kind of like one of the most fundamental, most important characters in the Muppet pantheon. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Because he's really doesn't have a lot of lines. He's very physical. And in the original Muppet movie, he, you know, spoiler alert, he's a very critical character in turning the plot around.
Right, right, right.
At the very end, he grows into a giant animal Muppet and takes the bad guy and boop, kicks him out of the way.
So he's got superpowers?
Dr. Honey, what is it?
Honeydew.
Honeydew and Beaker, they accidentally... Yeah. Blow him up into a giant monster, you know.
So he becomes Gandalf the Red, is what you're saying.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, you know, you're one of the few actors who's actually been cramped into these difficult situations with these very iconic characters, the Muppets.
I mean, I felt bad for like on that. Yeah. You may have seen it. The
Toyota ads,
the Highlander commercial. It was. I mean, these were the original. You know, Henson Workshop people. So they're all, you know, in their 60s and 70s because they're old school original people who worked with them. But they're down there because of the, you know, the functionality of being a Muppeteer or a puppeteer in any situation. You're going to be cramped down below while the thing's up there. I'm like, do they give you people physiotherapists or like free patellas? What's
so they didn't modify the car at all to accommodate all the puppeteers?
They do, and so there's effectively no bottom on the car.
Okay.
But they still have to be, you know, cramped down in there because there's four or five of them down below with their hands stretched up. So physiologically,
wow. Daddy.
That's right. And that's the tie-in to daddy issues. I auditioned for car issues, but I just didn't get it.
So they're sort of like right there, their face is right at your crotch level, and they're shoving this puppet in your face and you're trying to like, you know, really be relaxed and happy and wholesome. And
hey man, I was not relaxed, but only because I was fanboying out because here I was like right beside these icons and I just became Ralph Wiggum. I was like, do you like stuff? That's great. I was Ralph Wiggum around Lisa Simpson. 100%. I'll say it. I was just like,
did you find yourself talking to the puppets as though like they're real people?
It's funny you mention that. Like when they become so intertwined with their Muppets over the years that, you know, if they're hanging out at lunch and they're talking, imagine somebody has their right hand up as if they have a Muppet on it, but there's no Muppet on it. And they're like, oh, that's interesting. They might cock their hand to the right or cock it to the left as if it's there because that's just a natural extension of what they do. So when they're talking to you, their hands are still going.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Muscle memory just...
Exactly.
Well, like psychologically, it must be really great for them because I've noticed that sometimes in, you know, when you're trying to connect with a person, not making eye contact can actually be a very safe way to connect on a deeper level. And I imagine that the ability to sort of transform your life and your body and your arms into this beloved character can actually break down some boundaries in their lives.
Yeah. I mean, you always had to, I mean, certainly in, that's sort of the, not tragic, but that's the downside of the logistics of filmmaking, that when you have these really proximal scenes being filmed, you know, if you're doing a love scene or somebody's just incredibly close, and because of the nature of where the camera has to be to get that person's reaction, you actually can't make eye contact. Like the camera might be in front of you or blocking. So what, you know, they're looking at a green X that's taped just beside the camera lens. So they're, you have to connect with a certain amount of detachment. And listen, I mean, am I an air traffic controller? Do I have that pressure? No. But those are the unique, specific complexities of a job that require you to be emotionally attached, but physically detached. And certainly with, you know, with daddy issues or, you know, other, you know, really tight scenes like that, that's just sort of the network of things. That's the mind, emotional minefield that you have to navigate to bring something across to the audience while you yourself as the actor are disconnected from the other person.
But it's interesting because like you do a lot of work that's really quick, you know, commercials and voiceover work. And then you're doing these other projects that are just really demand a lot of you psychologically and time wise and growing character across experiences.
Sure.
Is there any different muscles that you're flexing for one versus the other, or is it just time is the element there?
There's a lot of things. I'm doing an amazing musical right now called More Guns, the NRA musical, and it's an amazing
by
piece. Second City, we just got extended till the end of August, so we're really stoked about that.
Congratulations!
Thank you. It's difficult because, sadly, it's an incredibly prescient piece, and where there is, we're never more than a few days away from a mass shooting, and to be able to do some to impart that idea in a comedic environment like Second City, and to do it across in bring it across in a comedic way, where you're never more than a few days away from a mash. I mean, yesterday was the San Diego Synagogue, and that was hours before the show went up. So in some cases, the audience, it is a release, that we become the vehicle through which they can express their grief and a possibility of how we can move forward. In other cases, they don't want to hear about it. It's just the wound is too fresh. To your question of how do you approach these things? Is it specific? Do you approach it in a larger way? TV and film is a lab. Like you isolate a very specific moment and a specific point, whereas a musical or a play is the long bow of the cello. And you just think of, the greatest pieces of Yo-Yo Ma and how he might perform. And that is the long breath. We're not sort of the tapas of, vines or Snapchat where it's a momentary thing, but just like a long, just a long bow of a cello. And that's so the different art forms approach the things we're trying to talk about in a different way, sometimes as short breaths, sometimes in really long ones.
Well, what's the show like? I mean, because it's a dark topic.
Yeah. It's an incredible, it does it in a way. It makes Philip Labus and Michael Okonis, who wrote it and composed it, genius. They do it in a way because it is such a heavy topic. They're very much aware that, you can't preach. An audience never wants to be preached to. And especially in this day and age, people have so much information coming at them. There's a quick triage of information where they quickly separate out what is and is not necessary. So if you try to bang somebody over the head, like with message, most of the time people will say, I get it, but what's your point? And they get to their point in a really funny way. Like when we go to, for example, when we go to the gun show, where it can be absolute, chaos and no rules exist in terms of background checks or whatnot, to them, it's like, well, the chaos is kind of like a puppet show. So they do it at the gun show as a puppet show. And it's a really hilarious number about the gun show as a puppet show. Because that's their way into the, they're saying a gun show is chaos. What's also chaos? It's a puppet show. Mm. And, that's not a new idea. Like Johnny Depp approaches Pirates of the Caribbean saying, okay, pirates were the rock stars of their day. Who's a rock star? Let me take one of the stones and put it up there. So that map over is very much what that map over of ideas is, a great access for audiences to come in to a heavy issue with a lighter heart.
What kind of reaction have you gotten from the public? Because, guns are, they're a touchy subject for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's an amazing reaction. Like this is our second extension. We've had pretty much sold out houses, and they say a lot of the time, they say, thank you. I don't know how to do this. I don't have the words anymore. We feel there is, and oftentimes people have, I have no more tears left to shed, and find a way to not just laugh through this, because we're not going to laugh off the subject, but how can we find access to the subject through laughter and find access to solutions? I mean, in a very similar fashion, John Oliver takes on these incredibly heavy subjects of like civil forfeiture and I think a recent one that he did was on trailer parks and who owns the trailer parks and who owns the land underneath it. It's a heavy subject talking about debt.
But also hilarious too.
But hilarious because yeah. he gives, you yeah. know, he finds those little, like he finds his road and then his jokes are like little campgrounds off the road. And so at the end, he gives like, well, what can we do about it? Is it a matter of calling your representative or, you know, putting your money towards this investment or that investment? So A, he finds the little minute jokes without diminishing the issue. And he has some means of, you know, approaching a solution, that we can do in a, you know, think globally, act globally, act locally kind of way.
Do you think we're seeing the last days of the NRA? Right now they're being sued for violating campaign finance laws and illegally coordinating with Republican campaigns, including the campaign of Donald Trump. And then their president, Oliver North, who's a notorious war criminal, has just been forced down. Mm-hmm. And people are just sort of speculating that in the past, a lot of politicians, even entertainers and public figures, were sort of a little bit fearful of laughing or ridiculing or criticizing the NRA, and now everybody's like, the gloves are off. Mm. And even one pundit actually was saying that, like, not only is this the last days of the NRA, it's like the Republican Party and Trump and the NRA are all going to be going down the toilet if the Democrats don't fuck up.
Well,
they've
also, the NRA has also lost a lot of their funding. People are just not writing them checks anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's only, unless you're a Russian oligarch.
No, there is no problem in America. Everything is going fine. What do you think? So have some caviar and do not talk anymore.
You have such a gorgeous gravelly voice. Mm-hmm.
What are you talking about? I don't know what you mean.
Are you, do you mind me asking, are you a smoker?
I'm not. Listen, I think my voiceover career would be a lot better if I were. I don't, you know, I mean, for the sake of my own health and singing and whatnot, I don't smoke, but
this
I know
is one thing
who,
I've discovered. We've been doing this podcast for 15 years. And if you listen to early shows versus today, it's like, hi, this is Fausto for, you know,
no, it's like the
Harvey Fierstein.
Right.
And I'm talking with other actors and they're saying that you need to train your voice for everyday speech. Otherwise, you're going to destroy it when you start getting older. Is that true? Yeah,
I think you should, you know, like any profession, you've got to make sure keep your tools sharp. You know, if you're a surgeon, you go to conferences and keep your mind sharp. And I had a great mentor, this guy, Robin Phillips, who was headed up the Royal Shakespeare Company and directed Aspects of Love on Broadway and quite a storied theatrical director. And one of the things he taught was that you as a performer are a conduit, and your conduit on one side is the writer of the film or the play. And on the other side is the audience. So your job is to be the clearest conduit that you can be. And if you ever have any kinks in your conduit, and that might be vocal, that might be physical, maybe there's a speech impediment. Sometimes that speech impediment is your conduit and you don't want to correct that, but you have to, your job, you know, of the many jobs that you have, is to be the most open conduit and the best passage from that idea to the audience. And his definition, and I kind of, you know, take it to heart, is that acting is the sharing of a given thought with an audience. So to the notion of, you know, you have to keep your voice in a certain shape. I think you have to keep it in the shape that allows the idea to pass through. Sometimes, you know, when you are doing a gig, if you're seeing sometimes that gravelly throat is the best thing for that idea to come across. You just have to be conscious of it and you have to be aware of it. So whatever yoga you do, whatever acting classes you take, whatever philosophy you take, whatever, you know, diet you take on, that is forefront in my mind as how can I best share that given thought with the audience?
Because I'm a big fan of Lauren Bacall, you know, and her voice was like destroyed by years of hard alcohol, cigarettes, and decaffeinated coffee at 3 a.m.
High point.
Well, they would put, I love that women of that, or just people of that era, they would like, the emphasis on certain syllables is how we pronounce our words, you know.
But you just have the really, I mean, I'm in love with your voice.
Oh, thanks, Dave.
It's almost a crime to not have you just be a voiceover actor, because it's like it just dominates your presence so much.
Sure. Well, listen, if it's part of the canon, you know, I've got rent to pay, so if that helps, I'm down with it.
Well, is that part of like what sort of got you in the door with Mel Brooks in the upcoming comedy Greek Gods?
Yeah, it's actually called, they changed the name since we produced it. So okay. It's now called The Olympians. And we are just at about 5 festivals. I'll get back to your question, but we just took Best of the Fest in Chicago. We just showed at the,
I'm dying to see it.
Yeah, dude, it's so good. It's so good. And it's like, you know, we talk about the Muppets, but, you know, Mel Brooks, it doesn't really get better. I've had the good fortune to work alongside icons and, mm-hmm. Of the 3 that I've sort of bumped into, he is like top, absolutely top. And, so it's an amazing film.
This is basically like, it follows the Greek gods and goddesses of Mount Olympus, yes. Very similar to other Isis films, like, the history of the world.
Yeah, it's more of a like a comedic PSA film. Mm-hmm. What if, you know, following the immigration debate, like, you know, I seem to be getting into, I'm in more guns to deal with the gun mm-hmm. debate. I'm in this to deal with the immigration debate. What if the Greek gods had to deal with the same family separation policy as that's existing? That's, you know, it's like if Hera was separated from Aphrodite, who was separated from Zeus. And what if we separated them? And that's obviously ridiculous, but that's the point of any comedy. You take the horrific sublime and you stretch it out to extreme levels. And that's what the Olympians does so incredibly.
Who do you play in the movie?
Sorry?
Who do you play in the movie?
I'm a sleazy-ass immigration lawyer that tries to, you know, like, use their... Which is probably true. How many immigration lawyers are there trying to, you know, use their own... to their own benefit, mm-hmm. You know, abuse their own power in the immigration process. So this great sleazy immigration attorney and who's Zeus, who's played by Mel Brooks, and Aphrodite and Athena, and is trying to, you know, try to get a little something mm-hmm. on the side while they work out their immigration issues.
And did you get to do some scenes with Mel Brooks?
I didn't. Mm-hmm. I was there on the day and watched mm-hmm. him work, and mm-hmm. it was amazing. But that's it. And what brought me to that was not, it was just like a straight acting audition, mm-hmm. and sort of through the UCB and Second City improv circles. I had done a lot of, you know, improv and musical improv over the last couple of years. Somebody gave me a heads up that this is being produced. I sent in I slapped on a mustache, recorded something and sent it in, like a video.
You needed a mustache for the role?
Well, I mean, it wasn't called upon, but you know, it's like, it's the low hanging fruit of sleaze.
Oh yeah. That's very true, isn't it? Yeah.
So it just, you know, it speaks volumes before you even say a word. And, you know, then I did put on the suit and slick back the hair, maybe use some margarine in the hair. Who knows? Maybe that was my product of the day.
Well, it must be very frustrating for Mel Brooks, who sort of had family members lost to, you know, the Nazis, mm-hmm. Dedicated his whole career to sort of fighting fascism, and to be in the United States and see the rise of fascism once again. It's almost like he's kind of coming out of retirement and trying to do comedy. And, you know, a lot of people are sort of saying, like, it's hard for comedians of the past to continue making work as generations move on and our standards and ideas of what is acceptable comedy changes. And mm-hmm. if you look at early Mel Brooks movies, it's like, there's no way he could do Blazing Saddles today. You know,
I've heard that. I mean, a good comedian, I think they find a way. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be the Blazing Saddles that we know, mm-hmm. you know, where the black sheriff comes up and says what he says, and I won't say it because, mm-hmm. you know, I'm a white guy. I think you could find a way. Even if you think about it, The Producers was made in, for the most part, today's audience. Like, it was only, I don't know when it first came out on Broadway, but not so long ago. And here we have, you know, just this, the Nazi menace on stage mm-hmm. singing Glory to the Third Reich. And that was still within today's conceit. It was, you know, we're backing up, what is it, 10, 15 years? The mm-hmm. Producers was on Broadway. So, you know, you have something as horrific as the Holocaust and the Third Reich being presented on a modern stage. If you think about it, even Book of Mormon, which dives right into, you know, elements of religion and the hypocrisy of, you know, selectively choosing parts of the Bible to, you know, to put your point forward.
AIDS in Africa.
Yeah. And they dive and right
the
into
wonderful
it.
Wonderful song, you know.
Yeah.
You have AIDS.
Yeah, that's right. Was it Hasadiga Iboe?
Yeah, that's such a great song.
It's a great. So in a sense, yeah. I think you can do it. You can do something morbidly offensive, but, you know, which, I mean, I love that show. I love Team America. I love all their stuff.
Yeah.
But you, I think you have to context them in a very politically correct environment. You just have to contextualize it more. You have to give a framework in which that comes across. Whereas
well, audiences
before,
are demanding more contextuality.
I think so. So you can say the thing. You just have to, everybody needs to know motive. That if you're just saying something, then people think, wait, that's your motive. You're saying the racist thing or you're saying the sexist thing, but you're not making a comment about sexism or about racism. I think contextualizing something, will make it palatable for a modern audience.
Do you miss being a zoologist and microbiologist?
I miss the specificity of it. I mean, certainly some of the work that I do, performance wise is incredibly specific, and being able to like turn on angst by up my angst by 10%, but lowering the tempo by 5%. That's hyper specific. But I do miss the, I do miss the specificity of academia that, you know, if you just
Some dumb people in Hollywood and you're like, I miss being around intelligent people.
Well, here's the mythology. There are as many dumb and smart people in all walks of life. That's the great cup of hot chocolate that you can take with you.
So you're like in a lab as a microbiologist and someone's like licking Petri dishes to see how it tastes.
I'm like, hey, everybody, Frank's licking the Petri dishes again. Frank, we just brought those in. Like literally, you know, I don't understand. They taste so good. Frank, what the hell, dude?
Well, it's like Jell-O, right?
Agar,
which is seaweed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just add a little bit of Kool-Aid powder and then you got a snack.
Mm-hmm. He's like, there's some wasabi in this. Dude, it's not sushi. Oh my God, Frank, don't lick it anymore.
Andrew, what was your graduate studies? What was your work in that scientific field like?
Well, I did my undergrad in, it was a honors degree in microbiology and, specifically zoology. So it's all animal sciences. So
you're just memorizing stuff.
You're memorizing stuff, but you're also starting to, you're in the beginnings of working with, people who are doing research in certain areas. So it's not just, rote memorization of physiological processes. But also people who are doing work on neurons or embryonic physiology, and they're actually, you know, trying to see what we can do to, you know, to really identify how all animal processes work, how we breathe, how, you know, we grow in utero. That was the beauty of studying at a place like University of Toronto, where research it's constantly at the forefront of research in any number of fields. So the access that you have to currently working PhDs is incredible, both with their work, their labs, and themselves. Just ask them a question of, I studied this, but where is it going next?
So was that something you just like did at a side, you did it growing up, and you were like, I'm going to study this, and then you just decided to pursue acting full time?
Yeah, that's kind of that. That's basically it. I'd gone to this amazing arts high school in Toronto called Claude Watson, and I the school in fame, LaGuardia.
Sure.
Yeah. So it was kind of LaGuardia of Toronto and really Canada. It was just an amazing place, and sort of a petri dish of arts, if you will. So I had done that. I was doing, you know, art throughout, and they had an amazing science program, really got into that, started getting into biology, into marine biology. So in a sense, I kind of fell away. And my parents were the ones who were like, what are you doing wasting your life in sciences? Get back into the arts. I'm like, screw you, Mom. Screw you, Dad. I'm going to show you and get a responsible degree.
But imagine that, like, in terms of science and zoology, you probably had to memorize hundreds of thousands of scientific names for animals and, you know, life forms. And that probably trained your brain to sort of go through, because one of the things, like a lot of my friend of mine who are in professional Hollywood jobs, they have to memorize stuff really quickly.
Yeah, that's true.
And so I wanted to test your scientific knowledge.
Okay. Well, here's one. Here's a great one. I took a great, there was a marine biology course in high school, actually, where we went down to Jamaica to study study reef ecosystems.
Yeah.
And at the end, there was a bell ringer test. This is where, like, literally you have 1 minute and you move station to station and they show you either like an animal or a fish or a piece of coral. And you have 1 minute to identify the phylum, genus, and species of whatever it is in front of you. So you get these crazy names like, Pandarus acanthifolium. And I forget if that was a brain coral or what it was, but we had to remember these, is it a mnemonic? We had to sort of create a backstory of the name. Mm. And it turns out we had a girl in our class named Pandora. So we came up with this idea of like Pandora and her boyfriend are getting all hot and heavy. And she's like, no, folium, folium. He's like, baby, acanthifolium. Pandaros acanthifolium. Boom.
Do you know the scientific name for a snail? That's one I got wrong in college.
I know the French name, and it's tasty, and it's escargot, and now my mouth is watering.
so for people who want to know, it's Gastropoda mollusca.
Oh, well, thank you. In fact, I did not know that.
And a Vini Vividici is, it translates to I came, I saw, I conquered.
Vini Vidi Vici.
Yes. Do you know what that is?
Yeah. I came, I saw, I conquered, but is a Roman, who was it? I know the phrase Vini Vidi Vici.
Yeah, but what the animal, the scientific name for the animal with that? What? Is.
That's an I came, I saw, I conquered is yes. an animal?
It's the a green Pacific parrot that went extinct 1,300 years ago.
Really? Yeah. Okay. Well, what is Abidephthys saxatilis?
I have no idea.
Well, Vini Vidi Vici, here we go. It's a sergeant major. It's like a little goldfish type thing.
Oh, that's so cute. Aww. Yeah, I don't even know what a sergeant is. That's a type of fish.
It's a type of fish. And here's one that would actually fall in right now.
Yeah.
A sesquipedalian.
What's that?
That is a person who uses unnecessarily long words.
Ah. Oh, and then there's an itty-bittium.
Itty-bittium? Is that just a tiny fish?
Yeah, sea snails and mollusks that are found across the globe.
That's amazing.
And I was like, I guess I'm looking at like all these blog entries about strange names that scientists give animals when they're, or, you know, species of life forms when they're discovered.
And right. Sometimes it's based on the scientist who found them or something like that.
Yeah. And one's called Ahaha because he's like, hey, this is something new. It's an Australian wasp.
Didn't they? Right. They named some kind of animal after Trump recently, I think, because it had a small penis and a small brain.
Oh, my God. Really?
I think so. Yeah.
Well, listen, we'll have to leave the internet to start naming things. Didn't they name one of the British Navy's, they gave it to the internet to name one of the Brits' military vessels or Navy vessels, and the internet called it Bodie McBoatface? That's 100% true.
It won.
The name of it's a penis snake amphibian named after Donald Trump. That's incredible. Mm-hmm. Andrew, it's a pleasure talking to you.
Such a pleasure talking with you guys.
Congratulations on the new film and all the amazing projects. I can't wait to see the Olympians.
Right on.
Are they planning a theatrical release for that, or is it going to Netflix and stuff? Or
I think most daddy issues. Sort of, we went the festival route, very similar to Olympians. We were at about 30 festivals, and you know, thankfully picked up some hardware around the world, in like Italy and Paris and all across the States. And then they hope to get distribution. Usually for short films, there's distribution in, you know, a number of, you know, compiled platforms where they sort of bundle, you know, comedic shorts together. Sometimes it's used as a pitch for a larger production, either a film or a series. So if you'll see it, you'll see it either compiled or if it gets taken to series in a larger format.
Oh, wow. And so, but do you know where we're going to be able to, when can we see it? When can the public see it?
I don't know.
Because it was like, a film festival for 1 day here in Chicago in April.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
And people were saying that there was like huge, they were thinking it was fantastic.
Yeah. No, it was an amazing. It was Megan Sunder, who's the writer and director, just, you know, really did a bang up job. I remember it did really well in Chicago. And I'll see if I can find out where the upcoming festivals are or if it's going to have more of a wider release or an online release, and see if I can find that out for you.
Okay. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for your time.
Guys,
it was
thank you for
lovely talking to you, and I love the sound of your voice. If I could put it in a bottle, or
maybe if you could just record it somehow and listen to it whenever you wanted to.
Like a podcast? That's right.
Like a podcast.
That's right. I'm going to do that right now.
Okay. If you love Feast of Fun, you'll love Eau de Pifco. Eau de Pifco can be found just in bottles everywhere. And near you. If you're feeling interested, call 925-555-1212. Operators are standing very close by.
You know, you just ruined somebody's phone number.
That's why I did 555.
Oh, does that go nowhere?
That goes nowhere. If you ever watch any movie or film, they have the 555 because it can never go anywhere.
Oh, I didn't know that. 555 Evergreen Terrace.
There it is.
Idea. Is that The Simpsons?
I think something like that, yeah.
That's right, yeah. But I think whenever there's the prefix, not the prefix, but the first three digits of the number, it's that means it's a non-function number.
You are industry, man. You are like, you got all the things. Where do you live right now? You're in Los Angeles?
I'm in Los Angeles, yeah.
Wow. And it's like, I hope that you have a beautiful swimming pool with lots of gorgeous people surrounding you and fine champagnes and sushis. And
oh, yes.
Escargot.
Right. If by sushi you mean some mac and cheese from 7-Eleven, then yes, my friend, I do.
Yeah. Slap some wasabi on it. It's good.
It's good stuff.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Andrew.
Okay, thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Andrew Pifco lives in Los Angeles, California. Daddy Issues is available for streaming at daddyissuesmovie.com. And of course, the NRA musical More Guns is every Saturday night at 8:30 p.m. in Second City, Hollywood. Laugh yourself silly. Because sometimes, honey, if you can't cry, you got to laugh.
Yeah, absolutely. You can also hear him voice multiple characters on Netflix, Carmen Sandiego.
Love we didn't ask him where she was.
I know.
Damn.
Maybe she's
still back. Andrew. Where is she? It's a live action, you know, it's a not a reboot because Carmen Sandiego was that game show.
Well, it's a cartoon still, right?
Well, it was a game show done by National Geo. Where mm-hmm. in the world is Carmen Sandiego?
Mm-hmm.
And you had Rockapella doing the music.
Oh, wow.
Carmen Sandiego?
That was like a 90s kids thing, wasn't it?
Or yeah.
Was it
2000 you were born like in the 1800s, weren't you, Mark?
Well, it's just, you know, I was not a child when that show was on.
Yeah, we had a TV set, and you were like,
yeah, but it was like
surfing the internet, like, oh, that's kind of cute, you know?
You know, to be honest, in the 90s, I didn't watch a lot of TV. I mean, there was Seinfeld and there was Friends.
You were busy drinking.
You know, Law and Order. Law and Order's been on forever.
I know. It's like, do you remember one of the first Law and Order episodes mm-hmm. ever on television? That was like, cause a sensation. Do you know what that was about?
Which one was it?
It was the guy who, I guess he was pushed into the subway,
mm-hmm.
and the subway crushed him. And so he had like 5 minutes left to live or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they found his loved ones and they were able to say goodbye. And then the subway kept moving and he died.
Yeah.
Like his bottom half of his body was being kept alive.
Yeah.
The blood pressure in his body was being kept alive by the subway. And of mm-hmm. course, moving the subway mm-hmm. would kill him.
Well, that's actually, you know, and it's based on, you know, like they say, inspired by true events. Because that's what happens, you know.
Mm-hmm. And so they, you know, the episodes are finding out who pushed him, and but it was mostly on the drama of this man's last moments in the world, you know. And he's like, "Tell me it's gonna be all right. Tell me," you know. And he's like, "I don't want to tell him, but we gotta get this subway moving. And once it's moving, he's a goner."
You think they would have just like clamped him? Just, you know,
there's no way to clamp him, honey. It's like that's a subway holding you together. Shoot. Hey, we want to remind folks that Feast of Fun is made possible because of generous support of fabulous people like you. If you want access 15 years of fabulous podcasts, go to feastoffun.com/plus where you can listen to in-depth, fantastic interviews with entertainers and artists and LGBT personalities and folks on the marges and the fringes of fabulosity. feastoffun.com/plus to get your in-depth, luscious podcast right into your hot mobile device.
We also have a Patreon. You can visit us at patreon.com/feastoffun, where we give you behind-the-scenes things. You can unlock our vault of goodies at patreon.com/feastoffun.
Thank you so much for listening.
Bye-bye.